From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now. It was a chaotic scene outside a courthouse in Fort Lauderdale, Florida today. A crowd shouted, "Lock him up, lock him up." The target of their anger, Roger Stone. The former Trump campaign worker was arrested this morning and brought to the court to face 7 counts, including that he lied and obstructed special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into possible Russian interference in the 2016 election. Stone appeared after his court hearing. He raised both arms in the iconic Richard Nixon gesture of victory. Stone was unrepentant.
I will plead not guilty to these charges. I will defeat them in court. I believe this is a politically motivated investigation. I am troubled by the political motivations of the prosecutors. And as I have said previously, there is no circumstance whatsoever under which I will bear false witness against the president, nor will I make up lies to ease the pressure on myself.
Those remarks came after Roger Stone was released on a $250,000 bond. To find out more, let's turn to NPR's Tim Mak. He covers national security for NPR. Welcome, Tim.
Hey, how are you?
Good. It was quite a circus outside the courthouse. Unpack what we just heard.
Well, you know, it was a very Stone-esque scene. He has been a longtime political advisor starting in the 70s, and he's kind of a proud political trickster. So you might think that even somewhere in the back of his mind, he might have approved of folks showing up and trying to shut him down with cries of lock him up. He has been now charged with 7 counts. Basically, the accusation is that he took steps to obstruct multiple congressional investigations into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. During that campaign, of course, Stone was an advisor, then leader, an informal confidant, and a vocal supporter of Trump.
We know, as we have long known, that he was a fan of WikiLeaks. He publicly predicted during the 2016 campaign that there would be a new tranche of documents released, documents that would hurt the campaign of Hillary Clinton, and he called WikiLeaks' Julian Assange a hero. So already a sense of the relationship that Stone had with Assange. Question is, do these indictments tie him to Russia? What more do we know now?
Well, the indictment refers to a point at which a senior Trump campaign official was directed during the campaign to contact Roger Stone about possible additional WikiLeaks releases. And so the question now is, who was that? And who directed that senior campaign official to ask about what might be coming out next regarding Hillary Clinton's emails and the whole WikiLeaks scandal that occurred during the 2016 campaign?
Tell us more about what you read in the indictment, and I know you have read it. There are some references to the Godfather and even a threat to somebody's dog.
Well, Roger Stone, as part of this indictment, he's alleged to have threatened the dog of a key witness. Now, stick with me. There's a man named Randy Credico. He's a host of a radio show up in New York City. And he has long been a fan of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks and has some ties with WikiLeaks. Roger Stone was trying to tell a particular story to congressional investigators about how he knew WikiLeaks or how he may have had some forewarning of what would come through the WikiLeaks dumps, and basically was trying to get this witness to tell his tale as opposed to the truth. According to the indictment. And so as part of it, Randy Credico has a very beloved dog named Bianca. And Roger Stone, according to this indictment, is alleged to have threatened the dog.
Did anything happen?
Bianca is alive and well and actually appeared with Randy Credico at his grand jury testimony last year.
So enjoying the spotlight. What does all of this add up to? When you have Roger Stone, you have 5 other Trump campaign associates who are under indictment for having contacts with Russia and lying about it. The White House told CNN that the indictment of Stone has nothing to do with the president. And the president tweeted this morning, "Greatest witch hunt in the history of our country, no collusion." How is this playing out for the administration and how close is this coming to the president?
Well, you look at the people who have now been either sentenced, convicted, or charged of various crimes and their relationships with the president. You've got Michael Cohen, the former lawyer. You've got Paul Manafort, former campaign chairman. You've got Rick Gates, former campaign advisor. You've got Michael Flynn, former national security advisor. Many of them have been charged with lying or something related to obstruction of investigations. And the question is, who were they lying for, and what was the general common purpose behind that? We don't have a conclusion yet, but this is the big 40,000-foot question that we now face.
Okay. Tim Mak, NPR's national security reporter. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks a lot.
Well, no surprise. This is a big story on social media today. Let's bring in Femi Okay for a look at that. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hey, Femi, how are you?
Hi there, Peter. The search engines are going crazy, certainly for Google. Roger Stone is the most searched term for the last few hours. More people are looking up his name than anybody else or anything else.
Yeah, we're seeing
on Google right
hashtag
now.
Mueller Friday as well. Mueller time. WikiLeaks is also trending.
This is
a bombshell. What else are you seeing?
Yeah, I'm digging around to see the little gems that you can only really find on social media. Mr. Chad Johnson woke up this morning. This is what he tweeted at 8:31 a.m. his time. FBI arrested my neighbor Roger before my morning jog. Huh. I only see that in movies. Crazy start to my Friday. You're only ever going to see something like that on social. We've seen all the video, we've seen it on cable news, but to get that neighborly feel and what happened when your neighbor has a knock on the door from the FBI, that only comes from social.
Well, the FBI agents who arrested Roger Stone today in Florida are also some of the 800,000 federal workers who are working without pay during this government shutdown. It's now in day 35. This is another one of the big stories we're seeing today. Big impacts at airports on the East Coast, including LaGuardia, Newark, and Philadelphia. The FAA has been halting some of the traffic there because workers aren't coming to the airports. What a perfect place to complain on social media if you're having trouble with your flights.
Let me just share this with you, Peter. This is James Womack, and he was commenting on Roger Stone's news story today. And he says, kudos to the unpaid FBI agents who arrested the traitor. His words, not mine. Hashtag Roger Stone. And then just to go back to how social is being used in terms of giving out information during the shutdown, the FAA News Twitter site said, we've got a staffing update. And they say, we've experienced a slight increase in sick leave at two facilities, and we're mitigating the impact by augmenting staffing, rerouting the traffic, and increasing spacing between the aircraft when needed. Mm. So if you're at the airport then you're delayed, you'll know why. And then some more basic stories about how people are coping. Just single lines explaining to people what their life is like if they've been furloughed. Ralila says, I was told I should have prepared for this. Not sure how I could have known Congress would refuse to do their job. Meanwhile, I'm turning my thermostat down from 62 to 60 degrees to save power while I work without pay.
We've heard from a lot of people who are these everyday workers who say, I didn't have the money saved up and it's not my fault. It's the government's fault for not getting this figured out. Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, getting a lot of hot water yesterday for saying he doesn't understand why these workers are going to food banks. But are you seeing social media used at all, Twitter, Facebook, to help people who are impacted by the shutdown?
Oh, this has been happening for over a month now, Peter. So people are offering discounts. You just have to show your government ID. Free haircuts, food banks are opening, food services are opening, the sort of things that you probably wouldn't expect to see in modern day America, but people are really suffering.
Yeah. Changing gears, social media users have not been kind to Michael Ertel, resigned yesterday as Florida's Secretary of State after photos emerged of him posing in blackface. It was from a photo from a Halloween party in 2005 when he was dressed as a Hurricane Katrina victim. Femi, what are people saying about that?
Let me describe to you what he looks like. Think about Carmen Miranda with a deep, dark tan, little white marks around his eyes, big earrings and a scarf around his head, and then a blue T-shirt where he is very well endowed. This was his Halloween outfit from more than 10 years ago. And the comments, as people are looking at this picture, say everything. This idea about blackface is a debate that happens on social media regularly. We had it with the youngsters who were surrounding the Native American gentleman earlier on last week, And pictures were surfaced from one of their games where people were wearing blackface. Megyn Kelly was talking about blackface. So, yes, of course. So this is a very rich debate. And people were just saying, well, he should have known better. And this is what you expect from certain people who are running from office. Millie Boram says, great example of past inappropriate and poor decisions catch up with you.
Exactly. That is an example of things that happened before social media was a thing, coming back to bite you. So good lesson there. Femi, okay. Go ahead.
You're welcome. My advice is, even if you're posting on your private sites and you don't think anybody else is looking, post as if the whole world is watching all the time, and then you'll never get caught out.
Yeah, just be kind, no matter where you are. Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks so much.
You're so welcome.
President Trump announced today that there is a deal to reopen the federal government until next month. And until then, you can bet this country will keep talking about walls.
A wall has to be built.
A wall is an immorality between countries.
You have to have a wall. You have to have technology.
They are so opposed to building a wall.
The wall has become a metaphor for border security.
The only reason the government is shut down is because of the wall, correct?
I was down along the U.S.-Mexico border earlier this week as the shutdown was dragging on. And as I found, the wall is more than something to debate. It's a reality.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
You're in Mexico. I'm in the U.S. What's your name?
Jesus.
Jesus is a fourth grader standing on one side of the steel mesh border fence in Nogales, Mexico. I'm standing inches away on the other side in Nogales, Arizona. His mother, Stephanie Camacho, is next to me. She makes this trip to the fence every weekend to visit family.
It's my sister, my son, my husband, my sister's husband.
They don't have permission to come over?
No, just my kids.
So that's got to be hard for you to be living on both sides of the border like this.
It's so hard.
Camacho cannot cross this fence. She says she has legal problems here in the U.S. that make it difficult to go back and forth. She won't say much more about that, but she did tell me that President Trump's proposed $6 billion, 200-mile-long wall won't work.
I don't know. It's just going to make a wall. They have more problems. I don't know, person jumping the wall, and I think it's a bad idea.
People can get over the wall.
Yeah.
I came to this spot along the border to see how the 35-day partial government shutdown is affecting life here at Ground Zero.
It's a hard issue. There's no easy answer.
Leslie Kramer lives in the nearby town of Sonoyta, Arizona. She spent the day in Mexico having lunch with visitors from Wisconsin, and she just crossed back into the U.S., stray dogs barking behind her, when I asked what she thinks of the shutdown.
And I think the most frustrating problem for me is nobody really wants to solve it. They just want to stake out their positions and have a standoff, and that doesn't help anybody.
Do you think any one group in Washington deserves blame, whether it's the president or Congress and the Democrats?
No, I think they equally share in the problem.
Like any border town, Nogales depends on the free movement of people like Leslie Kramer and the movement of goods.
So there's this large freight train rolling south across the border right now. This is coming from the United States, bringing what, parts or goods into Mexico?
It's bringing components for any number of maquila manufacturing in Mexico.
This is Bruce Bracker, a Santa Cruz County Commissioner.
What kind of manufacturing?
Ford has a large plant down in Hermosillo, so this could be stuff that was produced in the Midwest that's going down, components that are going to be parts of the cars that are finally produced.
So the government may be shut down, but at least that train is crossing the border. Commerce, to some extent, is happening here.
There's two trains that go southbound each day, and there's a couple trains that come northbound each day.
That's good news for Nogales, but it's too late for Bruce Bracker's family business. Bracker used to run a department store on Morley Avenue. It's a little block of low-cost shops where we're standing now.
In the 70s, this was literally the most expensive real estate in the state of Arizona. The rents here were higher than the rents in Scottsdale. And that was because all the Mexican nationals that were coming over here and shopping.
But Bracker gave up on the business a few years ago. He says customs restrictions after 9/11 slowly choked off the flow of customers.
I mean, you had in 2007, you had 7.5 million people walking across the border into downtown Nogales every year.
What was that like?
That was, if you were a business person, it was phenomenal.
Business was good for you and your
family. Business was very good for our family.
You made a reference to Scottsdale, which is a fancy, glitzy suburb of Phoenix. No offense to Morley Avenue now. It doesn't look like that at all.
Not even close. No, it's these are the hard times on Morley Avenue right now.
The government shutdown doesn't make things any easier. The Nogales Border Patrol Station is the second largest in the U.S. Agents and customs officers are working, but they're not getting paid. I drove about a mile up the road from the fence to take a break at Antojitos Mexicanos, a little restaurant known for its traditional soup.
This was lucky, just finding you here eating lunch.
And I just happened to run into the mayor of Nogales, Democrat Arturo Garino.
What's on the menu?
Well, this is albondigas. It's a meatball soup. It's great. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't do better unless you made it at home, actually.
You know what I was thinking? We're a long ways from Washington, sitting here in this restaurant.
Yes.
What's your opinion of what in the world is going on there?
Oh, Jesus Christ, it's unbelievable. I wish I knew.
Garino says it's time for politicians to figure out this mess and make a deal that will reopen the government. I asked him how the president's pitch was going over in Nogales. $5.7 billion for a wall in exchange for temporary protections for some immigrants.
We've had a border wall here for more than 20 years, all right? Maybe they should come to Nogales and look at the real border wall. You know, we've had one before anybody started talking about it. If you were to give $6 billion, and you would tell Homeland Security, Customs and Border Protection, Border Patrol, all of them, and say, here, look, here's $6 billion. You use it the way you want to. I can almost bet that they would go by hiring more personnel. They would go by probably having more access roads to the border because the topography doesn't help, you know. And then probably at the very end, they would say, okay, we do need barriers, we do need walls, because there's a lot of areas that are, there's gaps.
On past trips to the border, I've met with supporters of Trump's wall who want to see those gaps closed. In 2016, a rancher here told me that drug smugglers cut through his property and tear down his fences. Just this week, Arizona Republican Senator Martha McSally made her own trip to a spot near Yuma, where 376 people breached the fence and presented themselves to border agents for asylum.
They basically just dug underneath. You see the light down there where they dug and they shimmied underneath and then started heading north, crossing illegally into the country. The Border Patrol can't see on the other side. This is one reason why replacement barriers are helpful, where the Ballard side.
If you listen to what people from both sides of the political spectrum are saying here in Arizona, you might notice nuance that you don't often hear in Washington. Many Republicans acknowledge it takes more than a wall to secure the border, and many Democrats agree that in some cases, a wall makes sense, including Bruce Bracker, the county supervisor I met on Morley Avenue.
Can we take a little walk to the fence? Because Nogales is a very interesting place. It's a really hilly place, right?
Sure.
I mean, so we're right near a foot crossing into Mexico. But if we walk, what is this, to the east just a little bit, we're going to see this steel slat fence.
So we call it the Ballard Fence. Gabby Giffords helped secure the funding for that. She worked with Congressman Grijalva.
Two Democrats, by the way.
Two Democrats. There was some extra funding available. And this replaced fence that was landing mat, that was literally, it was just a solid green barrier that was pretty porous and people could get over fairly easily.
On the top of this Ballard fence, there's some barbed wire. Is that new?
That's all new. That's what the military came in and did. So
when President Trump deployed the troops down to the border, this is something that they did?
This started happening on Election Day, that the military mobilized down here and they started welding onto the fence. This is probably a 14-foot fence, and it has a no-climb solid steel plate at the top of it. And it's Ballard, so the light, and you can see through what's going on, so it's really secure for Border Patrol.
So you think that's a good thing? That barbed wire is a good thing?
No, the Ballard fence was a good thing. The barbed wire is atrocious. Constantino wire always sends a bad message. We're the United States of America.
You've been living down here for your entire life, I imagine, for most of it anyways. You're a person who says this fence is a good idea.
In the cities, this fence is a good idea. So in a city, a Border Patrol has only a certain amount of time to apprehend somebody before they get lost in the crowd. When you start getting out into the country, unless you have someone to man it and someone to maintain it and access to it, then it's not going to do any good.
Does the United States need another 200 miles of fence that the president's trying to get?
I think that it's important that Border Patrol has had a plan to roll out these barriers, whether it's a Ballard fence, whether it's electronic. They've been getting control of the border. But to come in and say that we're going to invest in walls and ignore ports of entry, and I know that I read the president's announcement, and he's saying that he's going to put $800,000 into ports of entry.
The number is actually $800 million.
Arizona alone needs $1.2 billion. Needs CBP assessment of needs at ports of entry along the U.S.-Mexican border is $5 billion.
What does that mean to you? More technology, more agents, all of the above?
That's physical. That's actual physical reconfiguration of ports of entry. So Douglas has a port of entry that's probably 100 years old.
And Douglas is just to the east of here, couple hours drive.
To the east of here, and Agua Prieta is their sister city, and they service some maquila industry, but they also service a very large copper mine in Cananea. And you have commercial vehicles going through a port of entry with passengers' vehicles and also pedestrians, and that port of entry is 100 years old.
And Bracker says that's the real infrastructure problem at the border.
Because if you look at a map of the United States and you look at the states and you look and see who the number one or who the number two trading partner for most of these states are, it's Mexico.
Whether Washington is listening is anyone's guess.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection said yesterday that the state's largest utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, was not responsible for the deadly Tubbs fire in 2017. PG&E still faces potential liabilities in the tens of billions of dollars resulting from last year's California wildfires, and the company has said it will file for bankruptcy next week. But activist Aaron Brockovich says the company doesn't need to declare bankruptcy, and that if it does, wildfire victims might not get the compensation they deserve. Brockovich is no stranger to PG&E. More than 20 years ago, she reached a $333 million settlement with the company over water contamination in Southern California. That case was made into a movie starring Julia Roberts. Aaron Brockovich joins us now. Welcome. And does this news that Cal Fire says PG&E is not responsible for the Tubbs fire change your argument at all that the company shouldn't file for bankruptcy?
No, not at all. Matter of fact, I was up pretty late going through the 81-page report. And they state that, you know, the point of origin was near a primary structure, but because the evidence was so damaged and burned, they really couldn't conclude it was PG&E, but they say, on the other hand, it wasn't. So it's a very difficult read, and we're going to have a lot of experts that are going to say that they disagree with it, but this will continue to go forward, based on this report or not, into the courts, and hopefully, you know, into a jury trial.
In other words, the question was whether or not PG&E equipment, power lines, were responsible for sparking that fire. Let's talk about the bankruptcy now. What kind of compensation would the victims of these fires get in a bankruptcy situation?
Well, I mean, I think that's, you know, that's a long-term decision. We've seen PG&E go through bankruptcy before, but basically it's going to be a reorganization. And so everyone, they look at their secured versus unsecured creditors, debtors first, Now, the fire victims could be first in line, but it would probably not be the full payout that they should get if the company was solvent, which, in fact, as we've discussed, you know, Blue Mountain Capital has overwhelming evidence that they are, but they would actually not get what they deserve. So, you know, if they're short, let's just, you know, I'm just going to say 100,000. I mean, in a reorganization or bankruptcy court, you know, that could get reduced to half that amount or less. So that is the concern.
Yeah. Blue Mountain Capital is a major investor in PG&E. They've written an open letter that says there's overwhelming evidence that, that the utility is solvent. But the PG&E is saying that even if it isn't responsible for the Tubbs fire, it can't absorb the liability from the other fires that it has been found to be responsible for. So how can you stop them from filing for bankruptcy on January 29th?
Well, I don't know that anybody can stop them from filing bankruptcy. You know, there's many things that the state can do once it's in, you know, the hands of a judge. I think what's very important is the evidence that's going to come forward that would allow them to continue would be things like from Blue Mountain Capital with their evidence that the company is overwhelmingly solvent. They filed the SEC yesterday. They're going to start a fight to oust PG&E's board. So there's a lot of information mounting that shows that they are in fact solvent. So you get in there with evidence and documents and a lot of information that can change the trajectory of where PG&E thinks it is they want to go. And the thing that's very frustrating is, you know, I've bumped into this company many times, starting back in Hinckley, California, to, you know, a very similar case, if not identical, in another town in California that settled in 2005. And now Paradise, you know, this is a pattern of behavior that's really got to stop. And that's probably going to play itself out clearly in a court of law.
Speaking of courts, I'm sure you were following this development earlier this month when a federal judge in California directed PG&E to reinspect its entire electric grid and then to remove or trim all the trees that could fall onto the power lines. Yesterday, PG&E said that would cost $150 billion. So there's some argument about whether it's affordable or not. But broadly speaking, do you think that's the solution to these fires?
Listen, they've made a lot of money and they pay out billions a year to shareholders. Yes, it's very important. I mean, as we move forward here in the state of California and we all look at climate change and the weather conditions that are changing, it's ever more important that this company has infrastructure that is new and will not fail during winds or storms, which it has done in the past repeatedly, yet still not corrected.
Well, I want to ask you about climate change. Do you have any sympathy for these utilities? And I realize that's probably a strange question to ask Aaron Brockovich. They are facing these very difficult and more intense fires because of climate change. It isn't as if this is an easy problem to solve.
No, it's not. And you bring up an extremely valid point, and it's not an easy problem to solve. But you don't get yourself into a position that you are now being found liable for so many fires by just saying, OK, I'm going to throw my hands in there, throw up bankruptcy, and let's just get out of this. This is the moment where it is imperative for the state and for the people of the state and for the fire victims that at this table, PG&E get to that table, the state get to that table, the courts get to that table, and look at what it is they're going to have to do for the victims and what it is they're going to have to do moving forward facing climate change. And we're going to have to begin to look at that map of how we get that done, or we're going to continue to have really dangerous scenarios affecting, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the state.
That's environmental activist Aaron Brockovich, who's once again taking on the California utility PG&E, this time over the wildfires there in that state. Aaron Brockovich, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And we're also following the news today that President Trump has agreed to a short-term deal to reopen the federal government. The shutdown prompted flight delays on the East Coast today. But in Wyoming, the oil and gas industry has largely been unaffected. That's because Interior Department employees have been working and getting paid to issue drilling permits on public land. From Wyoming Public Radio, Cooper McKim reports.
If you call a local Bureau of Land Management office here in Wyoming, you get this.
This is your Casper BLM. Due to a lapse in funding of the federal government budget, we are out of the office.
Nobody really wants to get the answering machine, especially not an oil company.
When you try to call BLM, nobody's home. We do get concerned about being able to react to situations that happen in the field.
A couple of weeks ago, that was Kathleen Scama's reaction. She's the president of the Western Energy Alliance, a group of oil and gas companies. At the time, she was worried about what would happen in her industry because of the shutdown. But it turns out, even though they're not answering the phone, the Casper BLM is issuing permits and leases for oil and gas development on public lands. The BLM considers it an exempted activity, paying workers to keep it going. Some public BLM meetings over oil expansion in Alaska have also continued. In an hour-long hearing this week, Democrats on the House Natural Resources Committee called out the Trump administration for what it called blatant favoritism toward oil and gas. California Congressman Alan Lowenthal complained the industry has gone unscathed while so many government services are suspended.
It is utterly immoral that the Trump administration treats one group of friendly businesses, the fossil fuel industry, as more valuable and deserving than all others.
Kelly Fuller says this level of leeway for oil and gas has not been granted in past shutdowns. This time, more than 200 applications to begin drilling have been granted. But in 2013, during the shutdown over Obamacare, federal documents show the BLM let almost 200 applications sit.
Clearly, it wasn't truly essential. This is just a made-up excuse right now to serve the oil and gas industry.
But Phil Flynn says he understands why the Trump administration considers the permitting vital. He's an oil and gas analyst with the Price Futures Group. Flynn says the first reason is economics.
It's a big part of the gross domestic product. If the industry slowed down, it would slow down the economy.
And it's also a part of the economy the Trump administration has been working to increase. The Interior Department has boasted huge gains in oil production and attributes it to, among other things, deregulation. And upcoming lease sales in February and March are offering unprecedented levels of new acreage, much of that coming from public land in western states like Wyoming. In an email, a BLM representative says the agency is not prioritizing permit processing over its other work and that its actions are consistent with the agency's contingency plan for the shutdown. For Here and Now, I'm Cooper McKim in Laramie, Wyoming.
The political crisis and economic meltdown continues in Venezuela. Some 3 million people have fled in the past 5 years, and more are trying to leave now because they can't find food or medicine or they can't afford it. So every day, some 35,000 Venezuelans cross the bridge into Colombia. Colombia shares a 1,400-mile border with Venezuela. Marianne Menjivar is the International Rescue Committee's country director for Colombia and Venezuela. She is now in Bogota. Thanks a lot for taking the time to speak to us.
You're very welcome.
Marianne, I know you just got back from the city, Cucuta, in Colombia, which is the main point of entry for Venezuelans who are fleeing. There's a bridge there that they come across. Who did you meet, and what was the scene like there?
So I was there 2 days ago, the day before the protests were called for in Venezuela. And what we're seeing is that on that particular day, growing numbers of people who crossed the bridge coming into Colombia to buy food, to stock up on food and going back to Venezuela, but expressing fear and uncertainty over what was going to happen next.
The fear and uncertainty, describe, for instance, a conversation you had maybe with a refugee or a refugee family, if they're coming in families.
So you see different types of migrants and refugees coming across the bridge. We came across a whole family carrying their belongings, what they could carry with them, who were making their way to Chile because they had a relative in Chile. So that's the kind of refugee and migrant that's leaving Venezuela because the situation inside has deteriorated so much, they feel they can't make it there anymore. Then you also see migrants that come across the border for the day to buy food, to buy medicines, to seek services on the Colombian side that they can't get inside Venezuela, but they go back home. So these are people who will take transport and walk to the bridge, cross it, come into Colombia, meet their basic daily needs as a coping survival strategy and then go back to Venezuela.
And what kind of things do they pick up when they're in Colombia?
So we saw people that were coming to buy potatoes, they were buying oil, they were buying onions, they were buying rice. You see families buying diapers for their children. We saw and met people who came and bought medication on the Colombian side, and they were going back, people stocking up on toilet paper.
And none of these things are available in Venezuela?
They claim and they say that these things you can't find quite so easily, and that they are way more expensive in Venezuela because of the hyperinflation than on the Colombian side.
So those people who are not coming just for the day to pick up supplies and then go back home, those who are leaving the country, you said some are going to Chile or other places where they have family members. Are they traveling as individuals? Are they bringing families with them?
We're seeing a changing face of the migrants and refugees. Before, we used to see men coming out to find work in other countries and to send money back to Venezuela. Now we're beginning to see whole families coming out. What you're seeing now is the much poorer people with less resources, in a worse state of malnutrition, low body weight, increasingly with different types of illnesses that they haven't been able to treat inside Venezuela. And they carry what they can with them. They carry clothing. They will carry a cell phone if they have. They will carry things that they think have some value that they can sell along the journey. And you're seeing people who are leaving so that they can get a bus onto another country, but also people who will then start the journey on foot in very precarious conditions.
Have they arrived at the border by foot?
They take buses inside Venezuela, and then they just walk across the bridge, and then they begin the journey either by bus inside Colombia to another country, or by foot inside Colombia to another country, or to another destination inside Colombia.
So if there are thousands of people then arriving at Cucuta in Colombia, what is awaiting these migrants and refugees there? How's the community coping?
It's been overwhelming for the Colombian government, who has been very receptive and has an open door policy for these migrants and refugees. But what's awaiting them is initially a period of hardship. I think it's really important to acknowledge the magnitude, the numbers of the crisis, and also how fast it is evolving. The people who are leaving Venezuela are just like you and me. They look like you and me. This is not a refugee camp crisis. This was the country that was the wealthiest country in South America 10 years ago. These are all people who had a good standard of living, and they've been forced to leave the country. And all they say they want is a job. They want the opportunity to be able to work and get back on their feet. They're not asking for charity, and they're not asking for handouts, but they need a hand until they can get back on their feet.
Speaking to us from Bogota, Colombia, Marianne Menjivar is the International Rescue Committee's country director for Colombia and for Venezuela. Marianne, thanks.
Thank you.
And people from Venezuela here in the U.S. are watching this closely. The New York Times reports there are more than 300,000 Venezuelans living here, and the numbers seeking asylum are soaring. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.